The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest-growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Hi, welcome back to Breaking Banks this week. I don't know if you guys caught the show last week, but we had a great session on financial inclusion, and particularly in respect to how refugees or people who are displaced in places like Syria cope economically when they can't get access to money. And sometimes when they cross into new territories, they can't meet the identity requirements because they don't have a working visa to even open a bank account where they are. So very, very interesting show. If you didn't catch it, please listen to it. But of course, in the news this week has been Apple Pay and the Apple Watch and the launch of the Apple Watch. I don't know if you're considering buying an Apple Watch, but the price ranges from $349 through to $17,000 for the rose gold Apple Watch. We mentioned on the show a couple of weeks ago that one of the really outlier stats was that to support the production of the gold Apple Watch, Apple is considering buying up to a third of the available gold supply on the planet this year. That's about 770 tons of gold. Incredible statistic. But Apple Pay was also in the news. Cherian Abram wrote a great piece on this in terms of the state of play around card fraud. Cherian, as you know, is a payments expert. He's been on the show before. He wrote a blog post on this, which if you can check it out on droplabs.co. And, you know, the basic message here is that the current card fraud is under 1%. But card fraud on the Apple Pay platform is about 6%. Well, this is the estimate, although it's not really clear. And the way this works is that you can provision a card on Apple Pay even if you actually don't own the card, as long as you just have the card details. So there is a way around this. This is obviously an issue. Now, is Apple Pay responsible? Are the banks responsible? Everyone's blaming each other. The reality is, the card number is responsible. We've talked about it before on the show. The view of us at Breaking Banks is that you can no longer secure a 16-digit card number. So you're going to get fraud like this occur. It's a problem. Also in the news was PayPal with their acquisition of Paydiant for $280 million. This is a pretty big deal for PayPal. You can see them ramping up to the split from eBay, and they're going out independent. But isn't it interesting that all of these deals we're talking about, another one that we mentioned late in the show last week was Abra, which is a global remittance business that's being launched off the back of the Bitcoin blockchain. We hear all of this payment stuff happening all around the world, and where are the banks? Who is really going to be setting the leadership in respect to what's happening next on mobile and mobile payments? Well, isn't the banks, the big players we're talking about, Apple Pay, Samsung Pay with Loop, Paydiant, PayPal, M-Pesa, you know, the blockchain, the banks are nowhere to be seen. And so while some are critical of Apple Pay, at least Apple's out there doing something, and the banks are just going to have to follow. I was asked at an event a few weeks ago, you know, have we already lost the battle for payments in the banking sector? And I think the answer is undoubtedly yes. Anyway, let's get on to the show for this week.
So this part of the show, I'm going to introduce you guys to a really interesting author. His name is Ramez Nam. But before we get into that, you guys know I like to geek out sometimes. So you will have to forgive me. I am totally going to geek out on the show today, at least for the first segment. Ramez is actually a sci-fi writer. And, you know, we've talked about this a lot before, that science fiction has this habit of really predicting some of these potential paths that we go in terms of the use of technology. And in this respect, Ramez has put together this, a couple of books on this, but, he's come from the background, being in the trenches, in the industry, having to deal with this. He did work at Microsoft. He worked on products like Microsoft Internet Explorer and Microsoft Outlook. He was a CEO of a nanotech firm. Developing nanotechnology, which is that in itself is cool. He's recently consulted with DARPA on some of this stuff. So, which is just so cool. I'm having a fan moment here, Mez. His latest book is Crux, but before that, Nexus, which was his last book, he's actually just working on one now, which he can tell us about a bit as well. But Nexus won NPR's Best Book of the Year. It was the winner of the Prometheus Award. It was a tied, actually, with Cory Doctorow. But winner of the Endeavor Award. He was a finalist in the Arthur C. Clarke Awards, which if I know many of you guys are Arthur C. Clarke fans, so that's cool. And, he's had some great reviews of this. The Wall Street Journal called Nexus provocative. Wired called it good, scary good. Nexus essentially talks about this, marriage of technology in respect to biology, particularly the brain, and how we can use this. And I don't want to sort of give the plot away of the book. We can get Mez to talk about it in a moment, but it's definitely sort of this marriage. What we'd traditionally call this area would be called transhumanism. Ramez Nam, welcome to Breaking Banks. Thanks for joining us,
Brett. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here.
So, Mez, what took you down this path of thinking about this area of how technology is going to change humanity in terms of sort of biological enhancement or the way technology is integrated into our biology?
Well, it's just been a fascination of mine. I spent 13 years in tech, as you said, and I used to read science journals for free or for fun. And one day I read a study almost a decade ago now about a rat that had had electrodes stuck in its brain and that had been trained to move a robot arm by thinking about it. And this was in a scientific journal. It was in Science. Yep. And I thought, my God, that sounds like science fiction. So just kind of dove into it from there.
So, it's interesting, isn't it, that a lot of the stuff that we talk about as science fiction, it's now just a matter of time before, we now have this potential to sort of execute on these ideas more than ever before. I was talking with someone about this the other day in terms of the Elon Musk, Stephen Hawking debates over artificial intelligence, and then saying, Isaac Asimov was so far ahead of the curve on this, talking about the three laws of robotics. He really had sort of thought this out. But now we're dealing with these issues. We're actually, we have the ability to imagine these things and build them, fairly quickly in fairly quick cycles. As far as being a futurist and a sci-fi writer, is that difficult because now we can so quickly implement stuff? I know William Gibson's talked about this challenge.
It is difficult. I mean, there are some things that are as far away as ever and some things that are probably fantasy. We're no closer to a warp drive. We're not one that really works. And there's other stuff that catches you from left field. So I think almost no science fiction writers saw drones coming. And now drones are everywhere. And you read the sci-fi that was coming out for all of the last 90 years. You just don't see that there. It's still humans that are piloting the spaceships. It'll probably never be humans piloting the spaceships, from this day forward. So we're constantly getting surprised. And the real progress is happening really in sort of info space and inner space. It's happening in computer technology and in biotechnology, as opposed to the blasters and spaceships that sci-fi has mostly been about historically.
So we've seen, we got the launch of the Apple Watch imminently, any day, with HealthKit and a range of sensors. Samsung has recently been parading their SIM band, this watch that has these six sensors in it, can measure everything from, perspiration, temperature, ECG, various stress levels in the body, so forth. We're now starting to measure a lot more about our physical being. Where do you see that going in the short term over the next 3 to 5 years?
I think we're going to see a tremendous amount. I mean, fitness sensors are just coming into their being, and most of them that you get are just an accelerometer. It just measures movement. But things like the Samsung band that you just mentioned go to the next level, and that technology is out there. We talk about the quantified self. Most people don't want to enter that data into a spreadsheet manually, but when you've got an app or a web service that's tracking it for you and giving you insights automatically is what you should do. Hey, you ought to go to bed an hour earlier tonight. You just spent an hour sitting around on Twitter tweeting, and it didn't even make you happy. Close down the computer and go to bed, man. That's actually valuable stuff. And then there's a flip side of that, or another aspect, I'd say. People talk about the Internet of Things, and that is gigantic. But one of the top things that we care about is ourselves. So I think the Internet of Us is actually going to be a huge component of this.
Yeah. The Internet of Us. Actually, that reminds me, a couple of weeks ago, IBM had this event, and they were talking about Watson. They were talking about the amount of medical data that is recorded, and they said by the end of this decade that every 73 days, the amount of personal data that's recorded on you medically will double. Right, so a lot of this data is going somewhere. The real question is who gets access to it and what happens with it, right?
That's right. And there's a tremendous amount of debate and lack of clarity about that. Right now, there are multiple competing vendors that build the hospital and doctor systems that you use, and they have no incentive to make it easy for you to access that data or to talk to each other. That's why it's so hard if you go from one doctor to another for you to access any of that. But when the device is actually on your body generating info about you, I think it'll not just give you more data, it'll change people's attitudes. Like, of course this is my data. Mm. I can see every other piece of data about me. Why can't I have this MRI emailed to me? Yeah. Like, that should just go into where all my fitness data is.
Now, I don't know whether you've been watching. I'm sure you have. You've been watching the news on CRISPR lately and the ability to sort of, alter genetics. And this sort of tends a little bit more towards the sort of stuff you wrote in Nexus about. Maybe for those that aren't familiar with it, just give us the synopsis of Nexus as the book and the premise there.
Nexus is sort of cyberpunk meets Snowden. I wrote it before Edward Snowden came forward, but the idea is there's a technology out there packaged as a drug. You swallow it, little nanites go into your brain, and they talk via Wi-Fi. And so if I have it in my brain and you have it in yours, we can link up sort of telepathically and send messages eventually. They build apps on it and so on. But it's also highly illegal, and it gets into a spy thriller with explosions and all kinds of fun stuff.
Yeah, a great, great read. For those of you who haven't read it, download it on your Kindle today, Nexus. Now, this, obviously, you can see you talked about the rat before. You can see where you've sort of got to that and taken it to a logical conclusion if you use nanites and Wi-Fi. But in terms of in your latest book, in Crux, you actually take that one step further, don't you, in terms of what could happen with a nanite that has a brain interface?
I do. I think every technology has upsides and downsides, and I don't want to shy away from the downside. So I talk about issues like, what if somebody else has the password to the operating system running the nanites in your brain? That's not a good situation if they don't like you, for instance. Mm. Or what if you use these nanites to give yourself doses of your own neurochemicals like a drug? That could lead to some sticky situations. I'm very much an optimist. But I'm an optimist that believes that the future is messy and problems arise and we have to go fix them.
Now, you're talking relatively near term in respect to this. It's probably, if we were to sort of take a guess of this in terms of nanotech, there's been some various estimates on this, but probably within the sort of 2025, 2035 timeframe, do you think that's reasonable?
The book said in 2040. I think that stuff will actually move more slowly just because we're always very hesitant to do experiments on humans. You know, do no harm is the first rule. And that means that we take our time and we're very cautious on things. But certainly DARPA, as you mentioned, I've talked to those folks. They have a big program on brain interfaces because they want to put things in the brains of fighter pilots or soldiers that have been paralyzed in war. They at both ends, both healing and enhancing performance. So they showed off something, a vision that they had at an event in San Francisco recently called a cortical modem, which is they envision this device that's about the size of two nickels. They can build it for $15, implant it into the brain of someone, and give the ability to beam vision into that person's brain without a screen. That's a goal of theirs to build. That might take them decades, but DARPA really sees this as something they want to build.
So we're talking a lot about not just, obviously in terms of transmission of images into the brain or sort of that brain-machine interface. There's another portion of this which is more achievable in the short term, which is use of sensors, which may be worn as a tattoo on the body or ingested as something you have inside you that collects more detailed data about you. That seems more realistic in the medium term.
Yeah, we've seen all kinds of stuff. Google demoed a contact lens that responds to your blood sugar for diabetics and shows them when they are low blood sugar. There are dermal electrodes, like dermal tattoos that have circuits in them that we've demoed that you can put on people. And honestly, one of the things I'm most excited about are technologies like Magic Leap that can do a rich interface sort of beyond Google Glass, a rich interface that overlays on top of the real world that I'm looking at.
Like HoloLens and those sort of tech. And
HoloLens, Magic Leap.
Yeah.
Augmented reality, I think, is actually more interesting than virtual reality.
So having a think about this, and we've got a couple of minutes to break, but having a think about this, how long do you think it's going to be before insurers or medical providers are linked into that data and really where there becomes this digital divide, whereas if you don't have these sensors or you don't ingest these little cameras or biomonitoring tools in your body so that it can give that data feed to these service providers, how long before someone will be disadvantaged if they don't take a technological approach to their healthcare, do you think?
Yeah, I think in some ways you're disadvantaged now, but I think let's talk about a diabetic. Right now you have to prick yourself and do a blood test. And if you had a tattoo or a watch that could use a laser passing through your skin to tell you your blood sugar minute by minute, that's not just saving money for the insurance company. That's a better quality of life for you. So I think most people are going to want this technology independent of the financial incentives for it, and hopefully it'll lower healthcare costs and save lives.
Fair enough. So who do you see as emerging as some of the stronger players in this human computer interface space? Is it new players? Because, we're talking about different competencies, data, technology, and healthcare, right?
It's new players to date, but I think you'll see the Googles and the IBMs and the Pfizers all want to move into it as it matures.
Absolutely. All right, well, Mez, let's just take a quick break. After the break, we'll also invite another guest on. And thanks for joining us again on Breaking Banks. You're listening to Breaking Banks. I'm your host, Brett King. We're with Ramez Naam, sci-fi author of Nexus and Crux. We'll be right back after this break.
Time. There's never enough. You just don't have the time to search out all the latest banking innovations from around the world. But the good news is, we've already done it for you at Banking Reports. 700 hours of research goes into each edition of our Global Banking Innovation Monitor. Be smarter and get one step ahead. Get Banking Reports sent quarterly to your inbox. To subscribe, follow us on Twitter at banking_reports.
Your bank's customers expect comprehensive, convenient, and consistent service when and where they need it. A mobile app is a great start, but with so many devices and operating systems out there, it can be hard to keep up with demand. That's why today's leading banks count on the Kony Multichannel Experience Cloud. With Kony, you can design, develop, and manage multi-channel apps from one integrated platform. Build an app once, and with one click, you can deploy it securely across all digital channels, phones, tablets, desktop, and more. That means more efficiency for you and a better experience for your customers. Want to get to market fast? Explore Kony's range of ready-to-run apps, including retail, commercial, and private banking. With features like person-to-person transfers, targeted campaigns, built-in integrations, and cutting-edge compliance, Kony apps provide the framework and flexibility you need to rise above the competition. Go beyond first-generation mobile banking. Visit Kony.com/BK to launch your multi-channel strategy. That's KONY.com/BK.
The successful businesses of today do everything they can to meet the needs of their customers. But outdated IT systems mean that banks often struggle to offer the same level of personalized service. SunTech is working with some of the world's leading banks to help them provide the products, offers, and services that their customers need and want. Visit suntechgroup.com to find out more. That's suntechgroup.com.
Today, make that long overdue call to your bank and thank them. Thank them for a checking account, one that has a minimum balance and penalties for going below it. Thank them for a savings account, one that has almost no interest and charges statement fees to let you know it. Most of all, thank them for overdraft fees and all those other fees you never even knew existed. Thank them today. Why? Because the future of banking is here, and it's not just what you want, it's what you deserve. Moovin is a free app and debit card with no overdraft, ATM, or monthly fees. Best of all, you get an instant receipt every time you make a purchase and daily feedback on your spending so you can always be on top of your money. So make that call to your bank and say thanks, but no thanks. And when you're done, download the free app and get Moovin today.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag #BreakingBanks. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks. Before the break, we were speaking with Ramez Nam, the author, sci-fi author of Nexus and Crux. Welcome back to the show, Mez.
Thanks, Brett. Great to be here.
So one of the things I'm interested in, we talk about often on this show, and being a futurist, I'd love to sort of get your play on this. Look, we talk a lot about self-driving cars. You know, Apple's going to get into the play, apparently. We just had the Consumer Electronics Show on with Mercedes and BM making their play. And I don't know whether you've seen that Audi has now decked out a couple of their R7s or SR7s, RS7s. I can't remember the model.
RX-7, maybe.
Not RX. That's the Mazda. No, these two cars, they're called AJ, and they've actually given them names. I'm going to have to look this up. I'm looking this up as we speak. AJ and Bobby, and they're RS-7s. So they have inside these Audis a brain the size of a small computer, PS4 type thing, and these things basically engineers drive them around the track to train them in the track, and then they can negotiate the track. And generally speaking, they're faster than a fairly competitive race car driver. Right. What's interesting is that they both have the same software, but Bobby. It drives a little bit more aggressively than AJ. And so these two brains have developed differently in terms of processing these inputs, right? But here's the question. If you're an insurer looking at the technology of self-driving cars, which is imminent. How do you make a decision about how to insure a self-driving car when the driver's input may, you know, theoretically, it won't be long before we have a situation where maybe someone who doesn't have a driver's license can own a car?
Yeah. Well, this is really a great story because I teach at a place called Singularity University in the Bay Area, NASA Ames, and we talk about self-driving cars all the time. And it used to be 5 years ago that people said, oh, you'll never be able to insure it. The liability will be too huge. But now Google has driven their self-driving car under computer control for 1,000,000 miles on real roads with zero accidents.
And it's safer than humans.
It's way safer than humans. It's tremendously safer than humans. So the opposite is true.
Yeah.
Insurance is going to be cheaper for a self-driving car by far than it will be to drive yourself. It might be that the insurance is paid for by the manufacturer rather than you. I don't know. But either way, the insurance burden is going to be a lot lower if the computer is the one doing the driving.
So this brings us into this future where the traditional risk model of banks and the traditional engagement model could really be flipped on its head pretty significantly, couldn't it? Like the way you assess risk on things, the way you, like, you know, if you're insuring someone in the past, what we did for healthcare or for life insurance is we looked at whether you smoked, whether you, you know, whether you got a pilot's license, whether you skydive or scuba dive, and we looked for you know, demographic correlations with risk. Whereas now we can measure actual risk.
In many cases, we can. Then again, sometimes there's future things we haven't seen yet that we don't know how to measure. There's also new risks. If a bank or let's say a large financial company runs a automated stock trading algorithm, and that algorithm makes a huge automated mistake, because those sorts of things in that complex environment do happen. We've seen flash crashes. Who's liable for that? Right. Not that humans haven't made those mistakes also. But that kind of gets into some other questions.
So this does introduce this interesting element of how, you know, customer-facing organizations will differentiate and provide their value. In the past, it's been, well, do I trust you? Are you good at, you know, can you give me a cheap insurance policy, whatever, things like that. There's an experience element to putting the product in your life, which is, it sounds like it's going to change. Why don't we introduce Joe Pine and get him in the discussion, Mez. Joe, welcome to Breaking Banks.
Thanks, Brett. Pleasure to meet you, Mez.
So, Joe, for those of you that don't know Joe, he is also an author. He wrote Infinite Possibility, Creating Customer Value on the Digital Frontier. He wrote The Experience Economy with James Gilmore, which comes strongly recommended. His first book in 93, which was called Mass Customization, did very, very well, winning many awards. And recently, Joe has put his hand to writing on banks and wrote a report with 5 Degrees on FinExtra, which some of you may have read, about invigorating banking. So, Joe, welcome to Breaking Banks.
Well, thanks very much.
So, how you know, this discussion we're having beforehand, how is technology changing the way organizations place themselves in a customer's life? Because we now have you know, some very big organizations, the so-called unicorns that have been created, companies like Uber, for example, who have placed themselves completely digitally in customers' lives. And, you know, they didn't do traditional marketing. They didn't do, you know, they don't run TV commercials and ads. It's just based on purely making your life easier and integrating into your life, which has been a driver for this. How is this going to change the way companies compete for attention, and what's going to be that trigger for, you know, technology being a catalyst for you starting a relationship with a company?
Well, you know, it's a great question. There is so much going on right now with technology in that. I mean, you know, ever since the internet first came out, you know, 20 years ago, I've always said that it's the greatest force of commoditization ever invented. You know, the frictionless marketplace means that customers can instantly compare prices from one vendor to another, and it tends to shift them down to the lowest possible price. And that's why companies need to do something with that technology and with whatever remaining physical interactions they have with customers to be able to engage them and create an experience. Right? It's the only way really to forestall commoditization is to create more economic value, you know, go beyond products and services in banking and other industries to create a great experience.
Now, I would argue that Uber redesigned the experience of a journey, and they did that by looking at a number of pain points, you know, the uncertainty about whether you're going to get a taxi, you know, the quality of the car and the driver, the payment experience. And so, you know, we've got this, as you say, technology is changing, and it has the potential to change pretty rapidly over the next couple of decades. And it seems that those old processes or those old competencies may not be particularly valuable moving forward.
Well, yeah, that's true. I mean, it does completely change how you interact with customers. And one of the other things it does is that digitization, you know, the ability to digitize, you know, one, your offering, which of course with financial services, it's all information, therefore it's all digitized, or your interactions, such as Uber has done, with your customers, even though, of course, it's a physical ride that you're going on, you know, that digitize, you know, anything you can digitize, you can customize. You can make it personal to each person. So Uber can identify who you are, already having your credit card, knowing where you are where the car is that's going to pick you up, so how long it's going to take to be able to get there and so forth. So they can give you a very personal level of service. And, you know, in the same way, any offering that is digital can be customized to that individual person. Increasingly, that's what people are going to expect from that technology, is let it revolve around me. I mean, Mez was talking about, you know, devices you can implant and that sort of thing, and it's just another extension of how much our own smartphones have become identifiers for who we are, representation of us, you know, with companies in both the physical world and in the virtual world.
So, Mez, I'm quite interested about this. Is that we've now shifted to this thing where we're very dependent on this device we carry around. At least most of us, you know, this smartphone, which is sort of an extension of our person, you know, our identity. In some cases, it's almost like an appendage we wear, or you know. When we start thinking about things like HoloLens and Magic Leap and the ability of these sensors we wear on our bodies or we ingest, and the ability to project data into our field of vision or on our smartwatch or on our smartphone, you know, we're dealing with a lot of potential information. How do we personalize that over time? You know, it appears like there might be some, we might get overwhelmed in the short term with a lot of information, but then it would seem that we would have to get quite good about designing that sort of personal interface or absorbing that information. How do you think it will change society?
Yeah. Well, first I wanted to say I'm just browsing Joe's books on Amazon, The Experience Economy and Infinite Possibility, and they both look awesome. I've just bought them both on my Kindle. So.
Congrats.
Thank you very much.
At least two sales today. So on your question, Brad, I mean, I think a couple of things will happen. I think one is the technologies will be packaged in a way that's probably different for different customers, and some customers will get a very simple or simple enough experience, like the original iPhone, right? Original iPhone with no added apps on it, with just the base apps, is not that complicated to understand. Now you can add a gazillion apps, so you can get an Android phone that you can root and do other custom things to and so on, and make it more and more complex for you. And so, of course, we'll have to have some layers of complexity for these things. There'll be different uses, too. I think we'll see doctors in the operating room using augmented reality, and they'll have a different specialized interface than your ordinary person walking around. I also think one last thing I'll say is we as society, we adapt and we get smarter. There's this thing called the Flynn effect, which is that every decade, raw unadjusted scores on IQ tests go up about 3 points. They always get curved to 100 for each new cohort of kids each year. But if you look at the raw scores, they go up by 3 points per decade. And it's not going up in concrete knowledge, not knowledge of facts and so on. It's going up in pattern recognition and rotating shapes and in what they call liquid knowledge. And one hypothesis is because those kids grow up in a more media-rich, more interactive, more fast-paced environment. So they just, their brains learn to handle more stuff.
Well, there's some interesting hypotheses on the, you know, the higher rates of autism and so forth in respect to that as well. But Joe, you were going to say?
I say you got to believe that how we are growing up today with technology, with media, and that is having an effect on our brains.
Absolutely. So, you know, there is an expectation set here that, you know, there's going to be more and more technology. You know, we talked about adoption diffusion, those sorts of things in the past on the show. But in maybe, Joe, in terms of the way this has changed relationship with companies, you know, people are fans of Apple. You know, they seem to have sort of tighter correlations with things like Uber today. They're quite passionate about it. Do experiences build stronger relationships with customers than just products and services?
Well, absolutely. I mean, because if you think about it, products and services are outside of us, whereas experiences, in fact, are inside of us. It's our reaction to the events that are staged in front of us. So you're reaching inside of people and engaging them and affecting their emotions, often affecting their intellect and even their body itself. And therefore, that higher level engagement is going to tend to, one, create a memory, and that's, it's not truly an experience unless you create a memory within them, and that memory that lasts is going to mean that they're going to recall you at the right time. The chances of that are going to go up. The chances they're going to want to have that experience again, interact with you again, are going up, particularly if you customize it, because then you can learn something about the customer, and because you learn something, you can better customize to them. You better customize to them. The more they benefit, the more they're willing to interact with you, and that gives you another opportunity to learn. And so you can get a really tight circle around a customer, create a learning relationship with them through the activities we're talking about.
I'm still totally geeking out and could talk about this stuff all day. So let me get a little bit practical then. Now, when we're sort of talking out the next couple of years for service organizations like banks, and FIs, who we deal with a lot on this show, what sort of skills are they going to need to remain relevant over the next 5 to 10 years? Who wants to have a shot at that first?
Well, I'll say something that's meta.
Okay, Mez, you go first.
I'll say that's meta, which is independent of the individual skills they need, every organization needs to enable experimentation. Because we don't know where it's going to go. So you got to let small teams at the bottom up try new things and have the freedom to fail.
Yep. Jerry?
Well, I agree totally with that. You need, in fact, two types of innovation teams. You need exploration and exploitation. Exploitation, you need to get better at what you're already doing and not sit still there, but you need to explore and figure out new possibilities. Mm. And I think increasingly that exploration is going to have to be done in ways that take into account the individual living, breathing customer rather than the mass of customers that are out there. And in fact, I would say often we need to go beyond the experience, particularly in banking, to recognize that we change via the experiences that we have, that we can transform because of those experiences. And often that's what we're really looking for with a financial company, is help me achieve my aspirations that I have for myself, for my family, for my business, for whatever it is. And banks that can use these things to help customers achieve their aspirations, well, there's no greater economic value than you can create than that.
Great. Well, thanks, guys, for joining the show. We've had Joe Pyne, the author. You can check out The Experience Economy on Amazon. What else have you got, Joe? Where else can we find out information about yourself?
At our website, strategichorizons.com.
Fantastic.
There's lots of information about that and all the books and everything that we do.
And Mez, where can people find out about your next book?
RamezNam.com.
Fantastic. Thanks, guys, for joining Breaking Banks. Hopefully we'll hear from you again shortly. All right, guys, we're going to go to a break. We'll be right back after a few words from our sponsor.
When you're looking for the right place to eat, there's an app for that. When you need directions getting there, there's an app for that. And if you're trying to make a healthy choice, there's an app for that. But what about an app that tells you how you're doing with your money? Now, there's an app for that. It's called Moovin, a free app and debit account that automatically tracks your spending. You get real-time feedback with every purchase you make and a debit account with no overdraft or monthly fees. So if you want to stay on track with your money, download the Movin' app for free on iPhone or Android and check out Movin.com. That's M-O-V-E-N.com.
The successful businesses of today do everything they can to meet the needs of their customers. But outdated IT systems mean that banks often struggle to offer the same level of personalized service. SunTech is working with some of the world's leading banks to help them provide the products, offers, and services that their customers need and want. Visit suntechgroup.com to find out more. That's suntechgroup.com.
Today, make that long overdue call to your bank and thank them. Thank them for a checking account, one that has a minimum balance and penalties for going below it. Thank them for a savings account, one that has almost no interest and charges statement fees to let you know it. Most of all, thank them for overdraft fees and all those other fees you never even knew existed. Thank them today. Why? Because the future of banking is here, and it's not just what you want, it's what you deserve. Movin' is a free app and debit card with no overdraft, ATM, or monthly fees. Best of all, you get an instant receipt every time you make a purchase and daily feedback on your spending so you can always be on top of your money. So make that call to your bank and say thanks, but no thanks. And when you're done, download the free app and get Movin' today.
Your bank's customers expect comprehensive, convenient, and consistent service when and where they need it. A mobile app is a great start, but with so many devices and operating systems out there, it can be hard to keep up with demand. That's why today's leading banks count on the Kony Multichannel Experience Cloud. With Kony, you can design, develop, and manage multi-channel apps from one integrated platform. Build an app once, and with one click, you can deploy it securely across all digital channels, phones, tablets, desktop, and more. That means more efficient for you and a better experience for your customers. Want to get to market fast? Explore Kony's range of ready-to-run apps, including retail, commercial, and private banking. With features like person-to-person transfers, targeted campaigns, built-in integrations, and cutting-edge compliance, Kony apps provide the framework and flexibility you need to rise above the competition. Go beyond first-generation mobile banking. Visit kony.com/BK to launch your multi-channel strategy. That's KONY.com/BK.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag #BreakingBanks. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks. I don't know about you guys, but I could have geeked out with Mez and Joe for another couple of hours. It's so interesting that now the rate of change and the speed with technology, speed with which technology is changing things like payments and banking and healthcare and driving, it's almost as if you can imagine it in sci-fi, then a few years later we can build it. So really enjoyed that. Looking forward to having Mez back on the show and Joe back on the show sometime in the future. Right now, we're going to hand off to Liz Lumley. Liz is, as you know, doing a series of interviews of women in fintech, or fintech leaders that just happen to be female. And up now is an interview with Kitty Parry, not Katy Perry. Kitty Parry. Kitty is, she must get that all the time, but Kitty runs a team at a business called Global Investher, Catalyst for Investing in Women Who Grow Business. And Liz interviewed her earlier about her contribution to fintech and how she thinks about the world. She's just been named Young Global Leader by the World Economic Forum at Davos. So let's hear the interview that Liz put together earlier.
So I'm Liz Lumley from Finextra, and today I'm speaking to Kitty Parry, who's CEO of Social Media Charter, and you're the next in our Women in FinTech Breaking Banks Finextra series, so thank you very much. So for the sake of our audience, obviously you guys work with social media and compliance and banks, so give us a rundown of what Social Media Charter is.
So we're trying to set the standard for compliant social media, and this has come about because of the many financial institutions in the UK who want to do social media but are nervous of doing so because of the compliance risks and also the reputation risks. So we put heads of compliance and heads of digital in a room together with the FCA in November 2013, the day of the Twitter IPO, and out of that came a solution of a charter, which is a set of principles which outlines what compliant social media is in financial services. From that, we then developed guidance, both in legalese and layman's language. We then gave it to the FCA. They reviewed it, made a few amends, gave it back to us, and that has been the bedrock for our process moving forward.
So is this sort of a social media charter for the UK or for globally?
Initially, the UK. We want to get this right in the UK first, but we've used FINRA, the SEC, and the European directives and the learnings from them to develop our guidelines. So it will become global very quickly. Obviously, many of the companies we work with in the UK are global institutions. You tweet in the UK and it's going to be read by the SEC, so you need to be very careful.
So, you know, you mentioned compliance and you mentioned FINRA. So these are all in the realm of regulations, and a lot of banks hide behind regulations as sort of fear of social media. Do you think that's fair that a lot of banks say that regulations stop them from using social media effectively?
I think the need for regulation, given what we've seen over the last 10 years, is important. It makes us as customers and clients feel safe that we're being conversed with in a manner that's fair. The issue lies where the industry doesn't know how to interpret the regulation. And that's really what we're trying to do now. We're pulling together the industry together so that we can interpret it together, all learn from different best practices and also problems to make sure that the future is much brighter than it has been for financial services to date.
So, you know, you mentioned, of course, social media is global, the global medium, but is there something particular to the UK market in terms of social media compliance that global banks should be aware of?
The policy-based approach of the FCA in London means that there are many different interpretations of the rules. And while social media is media neutral, we'll be seeing guidance later this year, 2015. It still means that compliance officers are unsure of how certain aspects play out. So we're setting standards for what compliance social media looks like in terms of proper archiving, ensuring employees are trained and know what they're doing on social media, what product promotion should look like, making sure it's fair, compliant, and so on.
So you mentioned, you know, you go in and advise compliance officers. I mean, what do you advise? What are some of the strategies that you give?
Often it's embedding processes. So we initially go in with an audit. The audit is 127 questions, which runs from the chief risk officer, COO, head of HR. We assess the company, look through all the policies and social media practices, and then pull together a report. That report has been pulled together by intelligence from lawyers, communications experts, social media experts. From that, we then develop the training, again done by barristers throughout, and e-learning continuously throughout the rest of the business. So it's in a way of the compliance officer enabling social media compliantly.
Can you name sort of any banks or financial services firms that do social media correctly in your mind?
One particular firm that have done it as almost an extension of their customer service to date, therefore very well, is First Direct. And their turnaround...
Our audience knows them very well.
Yes, exactly. They deserve to be praised for how they've run their social media. So they're an example of they're human on social media. They do it in a natural manner. They bring down the corporate... the corporate issues whereby there is no face behind a brand, and they put humans in front of the brand, which makes customers feel confident that there are real people inside that institution.
I'm glad you mentioned First Direct, because I think they very much saw social media as a main communication channel rather than sort of an alternative channel. Do you think that mindset is still very prevalent in banks, that social media is some sort of adjunct or alternative communication channel?
Our line is that social media will be to email what email was to fax. And that's one of the most terrifying phrases, I think, particularly that came out of Davos. And many of the CEOs want to hear it and realize it's increasing in prevalence, but don't understand A, why, or B, whether it's long term. Now, obviously, it is. And also that it's not just a communication channel. It's far more valuable as a listening tool. Understanding what customers want. Focus groups are so specific and often biased, whereas social media is honest and real and allows firms to innovate products rather than make products that are suitable, which is something we're helping them do.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about you as a person. And, you know, in your background, you seem to be a bit of a serial entrepreneur. So, you know, what drives you?
It's a really good question. And one of those things that it's sometimes subconscious, probably more often than not, thank goodness, subconscious, because if you thought about it too much, you wouldn't know where. But it's really the first thing that drove me when I was 16 was going to my cousin's wedding and seeing the food come out 2 hours late at a hotel she paid extortionate amounts of money for, and there was a bride that was going to be following her 4 hours later. And this factory mentality on a day that was meant to be so perfect for her made me really cross. So as a result, built and now help farmers diversify their income by running weddings. And that was the first industry challenging concept that we've now tried to repeat with Templars, the PR firm, where we feel there can be better ways of looking at PR through an anticipatory mindset that we use, and then has led to the social media charter, which is evidence of the Templars anticipatory mindset, anticipating the issues of financial services, being regulation and social media, and forming a solution to it.
It seems so many businesses are started with people who get a bit sort of angry at something, you know, and want to change. Well, I mean, in sort of in your career, what have been some of your biggest lessons that you've learned?
You know, I was thinking about the drive and the frustration that causes you to build a business as I was coming in thinking about this interview. And the biggest lesson is not to give up, because in America, it's celebrated when you fail a business, because in fact, that's half of the learning curve. You fail and then you build and you fail and you build. In the UK, it's much more frowned upon. And I think the biggest lesson is just to keep going. And you, when something goes wrong, it's not necessarily a then quantum leap of hope or something that can come out of it that's particularly strong, but just keep going, just keep reading your emails, whatever it is, just keep going. Or just call it a day, one day, you know, and then wake up the next day and it's a new day and keep going. Ultimately, it's the hard graft that pays off.
I'm going to throw in a little bit of an extra question, but hopefully since you had just been to Davos, you can answer it. How often do you go to Davos? Like, what type of experience is that, going to a big sort of global conference like that?
This is the second year, but having been in the conference centre this year, it's slightly different. It's incredibly exciting, and whilst from an outside view it can look like a lot of people with a lot of money all coming together and having a party, it's far from that. It's a celebration for those that work really hard. And there is not a time in the day, whenever it is in the day, that you wouldn't talk about work. And it's not frowned upon. It's a natural conversation, because everyone out there is trying to help each other. And that's what the World Economic Forum have done very well. They really, really try and focus on and help people working together and helping each other. And I think it needs more focus throughout our whole culture. It's great when people work hard, and we should celebrate that, because ultimately that's what's going to drive our economy, and in turn that will drive a better consumer life and so on and so forth.
When people are sort of fulfilled by working hard.
Absolutely. Then it should be praised and encouraged and focused on, certainly.
Cool. So what was the conversation like at Davos this year?
So at Range, we had a really exciting panel called Social Media Friend or Foe, and it was hosted by Eric Schnatzer from Bloomberg, David Kirkpatrick and Hugh von Steenis, and the output from that was very much, it's not a conversation whether it's friend or foe, it is happening and we need to make it, embrace it and move forward and try and do it safely in every way. And that really played out into further conversations I was having, particularly with the disruptive finance group within the World Economic Forum. And the
number one conversation of the past 2 years is disruptive finance.
It is. And I think whilst last year many of the individuals in the conference centre were probably rather fearful of it, this year it's fearful and wanted to avoid it. Now it's being embraced and understood, because it's beginning to take significant margins off big corporates. Mm-hmm. And how, as a large corporate, you can compete with that is now at the forefront of minds. And that's understanding how to do, for example, social media properly and quickly, because if the firms don't do it, they will be left behind.
So since you sort of were starting businesses from the age of 16 onwards, you know, if someone came to you and said, I have got a great idea for a new company, you know, what type of advice would you give them?
I will never make a decision unless I have all the information to my fingertips, because history allows us to learn and progress and learn from other mistakes and learn from experiences. in a way that no advice can give, nothing else can help with. So I'd say information, and make sure it's fact gathering rather than too many anecdotal stories. You want to hear exactly what's really, really happened so that you can make a very real decision rather than an emotionally driven decision. And then understand what your market's going to be and how that's going to play out in the next 5 years. We're going to see more, particularly in financial services, more technology innovation in the next 5 years than we have in the last 20. PR is going to completely change. We're going to be going online with video content, driving whole new campaigns that are really not going to be focused on print so much. And so think about your business model and how will it evolve and adapt. And the benefit of building a new business is you're going to be far more nimble than a huge corporate. But make sure you utilize that and are ready to act nimbly. And then two biggest investments, make sure your IT is solid, super solid, and people, hire really good people, and make sure that you do your due diligence when you hire them.
Kitty, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Liz. So you guys can check out Finextra, where you'll see a copy of the interview as well, if you're interested. This is a series that Finextra and Breaking Banks are doing on a regular basis. So, and it's great to have Finextra's support of Breaking Banks also. Now, next week is, of course, St. Patrick's Day. So I was in Dublin a few weeks ago visiting Ulster Bank, and met up with some guys just off Twitter. They reached out to me, said, hey, you're in Dublin, let's meet up. We had a coffee together, and we've put together a very interesting show on the Dublin fintech scene. Now, Accenture's just launched a fintech innovation lab in Dublin, so this could be quite interesting to sort of see, you know, is Dublin going to sort of be off to the side of London as a fintech capital? Lots of potential there. They're calling themselves not the Silicon Tiger. What is it, Rachel? The Celtic Kitty. That's how they've named themselves as a fintech center. I don't know if that's going to stick. I still like the Silicon Dragon for Hong Kong, but that hasn't stuck either. But don't forget, guys, that we are also working closely with the guys at Finovate. If you're interested in Finovate out at San Jose, then you can have a discount. Use the code BREAKINGBANKS20. Check it out on the BreakingBanks.com website. You'll have a link to Finovate there. So let's see. Next week, we're going to have a St. Paddy's themed Breaking Bank. So make sure you join us next week on Breaking Banks. That's another show for this week, guys. Thanks for joining us again. Fantastic show. I was really geeking out. Hope you guys enjoyed it too. See you again next week. Bye.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.